quite comfortable.
Sort of.
Well, that's what the meeting's about tomorrow.
It's me. Why don't you sit over there?
Jim, I have it, and the only time people have it on the phone.
We all hate it. It looks like we all hate it together.
The 21st tomorrow.
Weird. I'd love to have a spare bank.
I like a spare bank.
But it's facilities.
Sure.
And the central location, we don't have money to pay for people.
Nick Sully complained to me that Mr. Bryson telling him what the agenda was, that he was on it. And I assured him he would not sing loud in that regard. But I put together this agenda, I didn't tell anybody they were going to be on it. So, I think it's appropriate to the format of this proceeding that I did it that way, because this is a workshop roundtable, and we're not here to deliver extensive papers to learned audiences, but to exchange. Now, another aspect of the agenda, many of you have wondered which way it is going, and therefore I should explain to you that there is some principle that I attempted to put in here directionally, and that is that we start off with a discussion of some of these major trends, and that we address the questions raised by Kerry Simpson, an institutional arrangement. We come zero in on them, starting with John Rasmussen's comments at the end of the day, and then we'll think about it overnight and come back tomorrow and give Terry and Arliss all the answers that they need in terms of what direction they should go in that regard. Now, for this session now, we are going to look at that Alaska's favorite cliche, the great untapped warehouse or storehouse. Whatever cliche or not, the Alaskan future is inseparable from its land and the water and the resources of land and water. And of them, petroleum is certainly an unavoidable predominant feature of the near future, at any rate. And so, Arliss, why don't you tell us about that petroleum future?
Okay, I'm going to hit a number of different short themes and hope put the coherent stuff out in discussion rather than my presentation. And much of what I'm going to say, I think, is just to know or avert from me or just our common knowledge among all Alaskans. A few of them might be new. The first is that the Prudhoe Bay is the engine of growth and is the support of the Alaskan economy. Nothing else really counts in aggregate terms. And we've talked about number of dollars involved and multiplier effects, but I think one way of illustrating this is that in the mid-1960s, they have a population of about 200,000 people. Its economic base, other than Prudhoe Bay, was almost exactly identical to the base that exists today. With some increase in fisheries in the Bering Sea, there's been a reduction in timber activity, there's been some reduction in federal military activity, increase in federal civilian activity. The activity in Cook Inlet has the oil industry has come and gone more or less during that period. But the state is now supporting the population and of twice what it supported in the mid-1960s. And the only difference that amounts to anything is the flow of oil revenues into the state treasury. The number of people actually employed in the production transportation, approved AO hours is implemented. There are fewer people actually involved with our, than work for JAL, for example. So that the Prudhoe Bay is the economy of the state of Alaska at the present time. There are very potentials of various marginal things, but that, and of course that is the, it's the Prudhoe Bay money that the legislature has been apportioning to foster growth in other sectors, principally the construction sector. But that's it. Now, a couple, 3 years ago, Brad Tuck came up with some numbers on Prudhoe Bay, comparing the value added there with the value added in certain other industries to show what it would take in terms of industrial diversification to replace the Prudhoe Bay field as the support for economic activity in Alaska. And I took those numbers and did some back of the envelope adjustments for the higher price of the oil now. The value added at Prudhoe Bay exceeds that, the value added at X vessel, the world's entire fishing industry. That is, it would take a catch, an Alaska-based catch of 100 million tons a year to provide the same injection of dollars in the state's economy that the Prudhoe Bay catch. The world's catch is about 70 million tons. It would take for coal to replace Prudhoe Bay in terms of net value added within Alaska. Alaska would have to produce something on the order of 5 to 6 times as much coal as produced in the entire United States. That is, in strictly economic terms, the Prudhoe Bay field is worth more than the world's entire fishery resource, and worth many times more than the coal industry in the United States. And this is all concentrated in an area with a very few people. The Prudhoe Bay field, of course, is large. It's the biggest petroleum liquids field ever discovered in the United States or Canada. It's also probably the third or fourth largest natural gas field ever discovered in North America. And so the discovery of something like that is a rare and random event. And the circumstances that made Prudhoe as important or as it is or even economically viable are almost an accident. One looks at the cost of the pipeline and considers that as of the time that Vic and George and I wrote the economic analysis of the pipeline, that oil of the Prudhoe Bay quality was selling for $3.28 a barrel in California, and try to net back what would be left at the wellhead under those circumstances. We're coming out with minus $3 or $4 a barrel, and it required the Middle Eastern upheaval of 73-74 to make Prudhoe worth developing. And again, the Khomeini upheaval of 78-79 to make it a really spectacular finance. I said that the discovery of a field like this is a rare and random event, and the probability that anything comparable to Prudhoe is going to be discovered within the time to prevent a sharp decline in Alaska revenues is very slim. Let me elaborate on something else. This is the talk about the importance and the significance of Prudhoe being really a function of the energy crisis, the OPEC oil crisis, that began in the mid-70s. I think that is a unique development, and in all probability, the cost of energy, the cost of oil in real terms has peaked. It peaked early in this year as high point ever. This is an issue that's worth pursuing. I think that it affects a lot of questions, for instance, as Paul's statement about the rising cost of transportation. I would strongly dissent to that. The ton kilometer rate for moving bulk cargo is 1/4 of what it was in 1950. The cost of moving passengers by air is less than half of what it was in 1960 in real terms. And I think we're going to continue to see a long-term decline in transportation costs. As we've seen a great leap in energy prices, and I think we've seen the end of that leap, because as the world just will not pay, well, the price is too high now, that people will, the world will just not pay that much for oil. And what the oil companies, the academic governments, failed to appreciate is that the fuel use patterns are embodied in durable goods. That is, in buildings, and industrial machinery, and transportation equipment, and industrial processes. And that it takes the lead time in changing those is very long. As the buildings, the transportation equipment built in 1976 were those that were on the drawing board in 1972. In the United States, we sheltered it by domestic price controls. We sheltered ourselves from the impact of the first price upheaval. The inflation-adjusted price of motor gasoline in the United States was less than 10% higher in 1978 than it was in 1973. And now we're beginning to get that. The world is in a massive flight from oil. You say, well, something could happen in the Strait of Hormuz, and Saudi Arabia would come out of the picture, would fall out of the picture. If the world reduces its petroleum consumption over the next 3 years at the same rate it has over the last 2 years, Saudi Arabia could disappear from the world's oil producers the way Iran has, and there would still be sufficient production. And so in my view, the chances are that we've seen the top of the energy price escalation, and that those who look on a continuing escalation of the value of Alaska's crude oil royalties are probably misled. Also, it has changed the significance of Alaska's control over the oil and gas resources. There is no longer a scarcity mentality abroad in the world. There's a theory behind the Alpetco contract and the state's oil and gas royalties sale strategy is that a long-term contractual supply of feedstocks or of energy has a value beyond its market price. And that very supply guarantee is enough to guarantee the viability of a refinery or petrochemical facility. That was never true. But nobody believes that's true anymore. I don't think the state's even going to find Alpecos to come in and sail against the wind to the economic winds. That is, locate an uneconomic facility, an overpriced facility, in a market that's flooded with hydrocarbon processing. The world's flooded with idle hydrocarbon processing facilities. Let me say these with respect to the caution about how far the revenue is going to go. On the other side of the coin, Alaska has
potentially petroliferous sedimentary basins that are roughly two-thirds of the total volume of the
comparable basins of the lower 48, two-thirds in volume size. And they're undepleted. One of the reasons that we, and I include by Alaska the outer continental shelf and the outer continental slope, but that is the submerged lands up to 600 meters in depth, which is about the limit of the near-term petroleum extraction technology. Now the geological surveys projections of potential reserves in Alaska and are much more pessimistic. They don't reflect that. But just on a gross basis, there is no reason to expect Alaska to be any worse as an exploration prospect as, say, roughly half to two-thirds of the United States before oil was first explored. Now, Alaska is a high cost exploration and development frontier. It has to do with climate, remoteness, transportation, lack of infrastructure. Some of those things will be remedied, and as technology is developed to operate in this area, the ratio between a well in the price of a well in Arctic Alaska to a typical Texas onshore well will drop from 50 to 1 to maybe 5 or 6 to 1. But it's an area that will not be completely explored for a very, very long time. However, the North Slope does have, here's an example. The Kuparik sands, which overlap Prudhoe Bay field, were discovered in 1968. It was not until the end of 1980 that they were posted as reserves by the American and the Petroleum Institute. And the ultimate potential reserves of the Kuparik sands and the other horizons in the area of the Kuparik unit that are probably on the area of 4.5 billion barrels. Now, this is more than the USGS estimates for all the.
That's
you're talking about oil in place. I think you're talking about Kuparik sands, and I'm talking about some of that is heavy oil is clearly not economic to extract with present prices, present technology. But we're talking about a figure that's more than the Interior Department projects as the entire undiscovered resource of the onshore North Slope. I'm not about to predict what's going to happen, but the oil industry, in terms of its activity in Alaska, is going to get more important. There are going to be more people working for the oil industry as a result of these inferior prospects that take more work to get at than there have been in the past. It's conceivable, although not likely, that production will stabilize itself or increase. A year ago, I did a probabilistic analysis of North Slope production, taking the probable course in each area or play, and came up with about 5% probability that the North Slope would be producing 4 million barrels a day by the end of the century, with a most likely estimate somewhere about 700,000 barrels a day, a little less than half. Natural gas. Alaska has a vast amount of natural gas, as the Prudhoe Bay field, as I said, is probably second to the largest discovered in North America. It's equivalent to the reserves in the Saddle Rocks are equivalent to more than a year's consumption at present rates in the United States. We're talking about 10% of U.S., 5% of U.S. consumption for 20 years. There have almost certainly been other major discoveries of gas on the North Slope which have not been announced, which have not been booked as reserves for a number of institutions, among them the pricing provisions of the Natural Gas Policy Act, the fact that the companies who have made these discoveries are looking to bid on adjacent tracks and don't want to tip off their competitors as to what they're looking at. But in my judgment, probably in identified reservoirs in the North Slope, at least twice as much gas as the 26 trillion cubic feet are yet booked as approved reserves at Prudhoe Bay. Esther?
Oh, I just wanted to have you ever made a comparison to what we would be discussing if Prudhoe Bay had not been on state land, if the income to the state were just the economic consequences of that activity and whatever taxing policy that the state had, but no royalties, supposing it were.
Well, I think we could. I think we can see the answer to that in the state's opposition to OCS leasing, I don't think there's any respectable case that OCS oil and gas exploration or production is more environmentally damaging than onshore production. I think on balance, it's probably less so. But the fact that the state receives no bonuses, no royalties, and has no taxing authority over the OCS, plus the fact that there's substantial portion of the population dependent in one way or another on the fishery resource explains the state position. And if Prudhoe had been found offshore, the state would still have a population of 200,000 people, most of whom would be passionately opposed to oil development. Very little question about that. I think we can see a parallel in Massachusetts, California, other states where the people get no direct and the state government gets no direct monetary. The residents do suffer all the real and imagined environmental insults. I might finish up with that. There's a lot of speculation about what offshore oil development could do to marine resources. I don't want to address the Arctic, the Beaufort, but with respect to Bering Sea, Gulf of Alaska, and places like that, there's really no. I don't think there's an intellectually respectable case that there is any probable or plausible damage to any significant.
I saw a number of people wince when you said that OCS was no more environmentally dangerous than onshore. I think before we have a general discussion, maybe it would be good to get Dick Cooley, some of his impressions on the table, and then we'll go around. Maybe tell us what with respect to some larger environmental trends.
Well, I'll try to do that, John. I do want to say again that I was literally shocked when I saw my name on the agenda, and I understand what you're trying to do here. John has explained it, but I want people to know that I wasn't even last night sitting and thinking about this, although what you asked me to think about is something I've been thinking about for 30 years, but I'm not exactly the pop-up toaster type, but, I want to be great tools, but I, as everybody else has been talking, I've been trying to get my thoughts together so I can say a few words that may be helpful to get our discussions going. I can sit and look around this room and see a dozen people that are currently right up on some of the issues that I would like to address or introduce here. And so maybe we can all jump in the context of what Arlen has given us, we can discuss some of the issues that are coming up. It was rather interesting when Dick called me. I was sitting in the living room about 10 o'clock in California with Stanley Keen and his wife. Stanley Keen was Assistant Secretary of the Interior under Stuart Udall, and he was very interested to know that this meeting was coming on. Stanley is retired professor emeritus and is not currently involved in all of these kinds of things, but he was very interested in it. And it also struck me the extreme difference between Stanley Keen and the Udalls of that period and this present period with our new Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, who is taking an altogether different approach toward resources and the environment, which is the subject that I was asked to make a few remarks about. I'd like to just, in the context of Alaska, mention that one of the first studies that was ever done on this subject, a planning study in Alaska, was done in 1938. And many people here who are economists and others who have looked at resource and economic issues in Alaska know of that study. We all go back to it. It was done under Roosevelt's era when the first effort at some kind of state land or federal land use planning was being undertaken in this country, and it didn't really get anywhere, as all of you know. It finally died out, unfortunately, many of us feel, with the coming of the Second World War and less emphasis placed on internal resource developments and this sort of thing. But they did set up councils to undertake state plans for and Alaska is a territory at that time, had a council set up, and they undertook quite an interesting, very basic and important study. And their conclusions at that moment, their policy conclusions in 1938, was that there was no need whatsoever to try to force economic development in Alaska, to try to put money into subsidies for timber industry, for this and for that. It was going to come anyway, and that it would be much better to get to spend the time preparing for the kind of development that would eventually come, probably in a couple of decades. Unfortunately, as I say, that all died out, but it's a good base study to go back. And it's also very interesting that the minority report in there is one of the greatest minority reports I ever saw. It's one line long, and it was written by George Marshall, who was instrumental in establishing the Wilderness Society. And he said he disagreed with the whole report that all of Alaska should be set aside as a wilderness. My point here is that confrontation in Alaska over resources and preservation has been of long standing and is still very, very much with us today, albeit not quite as great as Marshall. Was it George Marshall, Celia?
Robert Marshall started the Marshall. Yeah,
Robert.
Robert.
George Marshall was the guest.
George Marshall was the economist.
Shortly after stated, I wrote a book published looking at land policy in Alaska, and at that time it was very evident that the issue still remains that of sort of either-or thinking about development in Alaska. Either you develop it economically whole hog or you preserve it. That's sort of an either-or thing. No communications together about how you can where that leads us. If we go either one of those routes, where is it actually going to lead us? And the thesis of my book outside is that this obviously is wrong. Somewhere there must be some way to bring these two together, that somehow we look at economic development from a different point of view in terms of quality of life and environmental values, et cetera. And I hope that perhaps statehood might provide that opportunity to provide, to begin to inject that kind of thinking. And at that time, the concepts were just coming out of new environmental concepts that for anybody who's interested in public policy, I think find this intriguing, because if you start looking at environmental issues, it's very much like looking at any public policy issue. You've got to look at the interrelations. You can't take one part of it and carry it very far to the extreme, or the whole thing becomes meaningless. You've got to try to take a, I hate the term because it's overused, a holistic approach when you're beginning to look at a policy issue, and you certainly have to do that when you're looking at environmental issues. And some new thinking and ideas were coming out in the early 60s, right after statehood, that I thought perhaps might provide some guidance for Alaska and its planning for the future. So, to use another old cliche, that some of the terrible mistakes we made in the past could be avoided up here. It hasn't really gone that direction for a wide variety of reasons, many of which Arlen has pointed up and many others. And things have happened very, very rapidly in this state since that time. Especially, of course, the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. First, of course, the Statehood Act, but the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, from the point of view of land and resource and environmental policy, was a tremendous impact on this state. And any of you who I came here in the 1950s first, and 99.56% of Alaska was federal land. And you look at that map, and then you look at the map today of all the overlaps and checkerboarding of federal, state, and native lands, and national park, and this and this. It's a mishmash. It's a terrible mess. That somehow in the 80s, we're going to have to work ourselves out of this sort of thing. Of course, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act culminated in the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which a lot of people in the lower 48, where I come from, sort of dusting their hands and saying, well, that's all over now. We can go on to some other big issues and fight those. That is, people in the environmental community that I'm talking about.
Well, as we know, all of us here and anybody who thinks about it, it's only the beginning. All of those new units that are being set up, all this new land complex of land ownership is going to require a great deal of cooperation and coordination in order to make any sense out of it, or everybody's going to lose. The natives, the state, the government, and the people of the state, as well as the people of the nation. So I see this as perhaps the most significant issue in the 1980s facing Alaska, is the question of what kind of institutional arrangements can be made to allow this kind of new thinking to seep into Alaska. The Lands Act does create this new council, and many of you here will be able to speak more about it, but and how it's going and the direction it's going. But it's the way it was set up in the legislation. It's not likely to have too great a chance for success for a wide variety of reasons. It's something that's been tried before, interagency type efforts that seem always to lead to the lowest common denominator type decisions rather than any sort of innovative decisions. I had hopes, and I know that others here did too, that the Joint Federal State Land Use Planning Commission, which three of us in this room served on. Esther was co-chair for the state, and Celia and I were federal appointments to the commission. And
four of us.
John was on
it
too.
That's right.
Who else? Mrs. Hurley is back in the back. She was
related to it.
She was
related to it.
That was, I think, the most unique kind of an experiment. And of course, my views are biased, but I felt that it provided an important kind of an institution at that particular time
when we're trying to work our way out toward the Alaska Lands Act, and most of us that were involved in it were pushing very hard for some kind of a really innovative institution to follow us up, and we were quite sad to see that Congress could only come up with this quite kind of model that they have. Now, I don't want to knock it too hard, because they have more to offer, but I believe, John, I might just leave my remarks there. I think I've opened up several avenues that we could carry along with the discussion.
Okay. Alan, I want to go back to some of the earlier things you said about potential fossil fuel development here in the state. Are you suggesting that the revenues that are derived from future fossil fuel development really constitute the sustainable revenue base that we always talk about, rather than the short-term Prudhoe Bay revenues? And there seems to be a pretty substantial qualitative difference in both of those. One seems to suggest that we have to start worrying today about the long-term implications of some of our investments. The other says, well, we really don't have to worry now. The revenues will be flowing from these things for a long time to come. And I just want you to address that.
Well, there's several aspects. First, there's a very large probability that the revenues will turn sharply down at the end of the 80s.
Because of
the depletion of Prudhoe Bay, and nothing else comes along with it. Now, stabilization of revenues at a given level, at $4 billion a year, probably will not be enough to sustain or to execute the things that Alaskans expect out of it. There's a kind of multiplier effect. For example, the Alaska labor force is about 15% construction as compared to 5% national. You can sustain a 15% of the labor force in construction only if you've got something like a 10 to 12% annual growth rate. And that large construction segment helps form the expectations. That's where the big bucks are made and where people make enough money to go and get active in politics and civic affairs. These are usually the most politically aggressive of unions. When construction's going up, people's value of their property, yours and mine, goes up faster than inflation, and so there's a tremendous momentum and sentiment to keep this thing going. Well, stable petroleum revenues isn't enough to do it. That is, it requires something in there that's going to increase exponentially to maintain the existing structure and to fulfill people's expectations. Well, the oil revenues are not going to increase exponentially at the rates they have in the past. So that's first. That even if they don't fall off, they can't sustain what people are looking for. Second, that with respect to diversification, the industrial diversification, the oil revenues, those cut two ways. They do provide money to finance infrastructure. They do attract the enterprising individuals from outside, and the existence of that oil money attracts outside capital and makes Alaska a fascinating place in which to invest. It helps both in an objective sense in providing an object for people to come from the outside and bring their capital the outside to try to get some of the oil money, and in a subjective sense, it provides the feeling of momentum, and it fills in the troughs in the business cycle. Over a longer period, though, it's probably destructive, and probably for a number of reasons. First is the inflationary thing, that much as government contracting during the 50s, provide the wage and construction profit standards that became the standards for Alaska. The salaries paid to state government, the loose state contracting practices, the willingness of the legislature to throw money at this, throw money at that, infuses everything, and the
the tendency is to drive up all the costs. Now, there are very few things that Alaska is nationally or internationally competitive in, or will ever be, say, within our lifetimes, be competitive in nationally or internationally. Where Alaska's had a viable, booming economy, it's in the case of the richest single fishery stock in the whole world. There's a Bristol Bay salmon swim right into the net. At the McCarthy Kennecott copper mines were the richest deposits in the world. For a couple of years, they were mining 29% ore, when the world average is now less than 0.5%. You've got Prudhoe Bay. There's other fisheries, crab and shrimp, very high value. Crab can be landed at the Dutch Harbor at $1.35. You've got to land pollock at 8 cents. And so there isn't the slack. So that Alaska has existed as an economy in the past and does today by the high grading of the immensely rich or large resources that have relatively low unit production costs, and great inefficiency is compatible with the low labor productivity, high transportation costs, and greater efficiency are still compatible with high wages and things like that, compatible with profitability. And now we get, if the state is totally hyped up, is getting totally hyped up in all sectors with this money. There's no Alaska as a place with a poor human resource base, poor infrastructure, should have lower real wages and lower costs of services from other areas of the country. Entrepreneurs here should expect lower rates of return, at least in the short run. What happens is that it reinforces the high cost characteristics of the economy. And for example, if shore-based bottom fishing had a chance in Alaska, without the oil money, they probably, and I'm skeptical of that anyway, they probably have no chance with the oil money because of the high real costs built into the system by the state's willingness and ability to throw money at anything. And so since it's state government that makes the principal capital decisions, they're made on a political, not on an economic basis. I think that the biggest decision of the legislature is the decision to replace the lowest cost thermally generated power in the world outside of Kuwait with the highest cost hydroelectric power, and to call it cheap because the state government votes the funds and the electric consumer is not going to. Private money into those areas where it can get the greatest benefit of state money. And if the state money is no longer around to bail out the sick ones, to continue to support these hothouse industries. The hothouse industries are now. So it seems to me that the diversification fueled by state oil money theoretically we could come up with a strategy.
I guess the
it's
question,
not going to happen.
Do you see that as a short-term phenomenon, this mass infusion of revenues from fossil fuel, or a longer-term phenomenon? And that's really critical for the types of deliberations we're going to have.
Nobody can say. That's one of the essential elements of dependency on very large petroleum deposits in frontier areas.
But aren't all those frontiers really in the federal area for the most part, Arlen, so that in terms of you really are looking at a bad picture as far as the state revenue picture goes?
No, there are still substantial potential on state native lands. And
the potential, the remaining potential on state native lands is still better than all other states put together with respect to oil and gas resources.
Can I ask a question along the same line with Bill's question? Holding the reserves constant, what is the significance of your statement earlier, which was that the cost of energy in real terms is cheap? It's like, will oil income decline relatively? Do you see a lowering in prices? Is there a significant?
Well, prices are going down now. I don't know whether for a while it seems that the Saudis are going to try to hold the line. The question is how long they can do that, because in my view, because it's this lag phenomenon, the flight from oil is going to continue. That is, the price of oil has way overshot its equilibrium value. I wouldn't put my money into anything that depends upon maintaining the present real prices of fossil fuels. I won't predict that there's going to be a catastrophic drop. I think probably the safest budgeting technique now is to assume that there will be some small dip, but certainly the price will not go back to 1978 level.
In the context of world oil prices, I think you're probably right, but in the context of the oil prices that we've been expecting, there is going to be in the short run a dramatic drop in state revenue.
When you say dramatic, just how dramatic?
I'm talking about expected FY82 revenue of about $5.3 billion and actual FY82 revenues of roughly $3 billion.
Which one is the
And right now,
Greg,
right.
Let's go back on that. Explain what. First of all, what the budget was built on, and give me a little scenario. I'm just kidding.
The budget assumed FY82 average price of the entirety of FY82,
July 81 to June 82, of about $28 a barrel. Right now, or actually not right now, back in June, which is the last month for which we have figures, the weighted average royalty value of oil was $21.50. The fall between May and June was 11%. It's falling at the rate of about 11% a month. There are reasons to believe that the price today in August is around a little under $19 a barrel. Now, you can almost take a direct ratio between those prices, that is $28 expected and $5.3 billion expected, and $21 or $19 and whatever you're going to get. Now, as Arlen says, there could be a massive upheaval in the Middle East that would bail these predictions out and to bail the legislators out who appropriated all this money that doesn't exist. But barring that,
So,
Arlen's long-term analysis fits in to what we have been seeing in the last 6-8 months. Arlen first discussed this in November, I guess, of last year. A number of us were discussing it in January, and February, and March. It just amazes me that no one seems to listen.
Arlen? A couple things in that regard to make matters worse, and that is that, if it's possible for matters to be worse, and that is that one thing that has always bothered me about all of this is that, and getting sort of back to what we can do about the future of Alaska, is that, of course, it's not our money, right? There has never been the connection made yet outside that it is not money falling from the sky. It is people in Des Moines and Chicago and Boston and places that cannot pay for their own police and school teachers who are being tithed at the pump to essentially give us that money because it's all domestic production, right? I was in Washington about a week after Pappy Moss's charming idea about bailing out Chrysler, and I caught Ted Stevens in a mood in which he was friendlier than he has a tendency to be from time to time, and he indicated that cost him 3 votes. You know, the day after Pappy Moss hit the AP, that cost him 3 votes in the United States Senate. You know, 3 votes on something as parochial as that is not something to play with. You know, as the Reagan budget cuts, which have not even really been felt yet, start to come home with a vengeance, and people start looking at what on earth it is we've done with their money, I would suggest that even though you could give them logical arguments about the fact that we've been bamboozled ourselves, that they're going to take it away, or there will be efforts made to take it away. And frankly, I am very concerned about the way this Hammond PR campaign is coming across in the press. It's looking like we're trying to buy them out. And people aren't as stupid as we might, as Bob Clark might think. You know, I mean, it is being perceived nationally that essentially Alaska is using some of its money in a propaganda campaign to keep it. So I'd be interested, first of all, in your comments in terms of your assessment of that situation. And secondly, which I think is even more important, and with all due respect to the people in the legislature in this room, I think they're out of control. And I think they're out of control because ultimately, if you're a politician, what you want to do is to get reelected. If, in fact, you can do good as a fringe benefit of getting reelected, you will do so. But as Senator Stimson said with respect to the stampede in the legislature to repeal the income tax, which all right-thinking people knew was stupid, and you look at what's happened with this hydroelectric madness, I mean, Ed Dankwa should be run out of the legislature for that. Not people shouldn't think that it's cute, it's such a disaster. You know, I am wondering, with all of that, plus these very pessimistic revenue projections, what on earth it is we're going to do around here in the next 5 or 10 years. And maybe someone starting with Arlen could comment on that. Well, and then maybe some of the legislators.
Of course, I don't believe there's any likelihood that Congress is going to take the money away from Alaska. You just start thinking of what kind of law and what kind of provision would be necessary to do it and what other interests that would strike It might be in Alaska's interest, not only in the national interest that some of that money be taken away, but I don't think it's going to happen. I can't see the political formulation.
In other words, in the same vein, you don't see Congress responding to the court action which upheld Montana's severance tax.
No, there's some other things which make Alaska a little less vulnerable, and that is that that consumers don't pay the Alaska royalties or severance tax. The price of oil is not. See, the Montana coal went into regulated public utilities, so it's a cost. So it's in a cost plus system. Alaska oil is in a world price minus system. That is the price consumers pay for petroleum products. What Alaska's taxes and royalties have nothing to do, have no influence on what Lower 48 consumers pay for petroleum products.
Really, we do take
the taxes. Yeah. No, the taxes don't. Now, the more likely aggressor
already
is the federal government itself. Although right now the federal government, with its eye on those revenues, is helping Alaska increase them. A deal has now been put together by the administration and key members of both houses to get a waiver of the prohibition on exporting Alaska oil. And the Reagan administration is going to sponsor precisely the same deal that Bob Loresh and I we're trying to get through 2 years ago in the Congress killed. That is a three-way swap with Mexico and Japan. The oil companies are not giving any aid and comfort to this or not even supporting it tacitly because as their tax rate on additional income at the wellhead is more than 90%. That is, as the state, the royalties and severance tax, the federal and state income tax, and windfall profits tax. The oil companies get almost nothing of any increase to the wellhead. So say it's 10%. It was 9% under the old tax law. Say they get 10% of it. If their additional domestic transportation costs, one tenth of that transportation cost ends up as net cash flow. They're ahead by putting the stuff in a Jones Act tanker and driving it around the world a couple of times to use up some of that wellhead price. What the administration did, and the initiative comes from Treasury, is because Reagan is going to run an enormously unbalanced budget. Where can you get some cheap additional taxes? As you do something that reduces the transportation cost on Alaska oil, and you can pick up another billion to a billion and a quarter next fiscal year in windfall profits taxes and corporate income taxes by negotiating swaps. So here the greed of the rest of the country is going to increase, may increase the wellhead price by $2 or even more if enough of it is exported to do away with the discounting of oil on the West Coast, of crude oil on the West Coast of Ireland.
I tend to agree with your comment on the severance tax issue. It's clearly, before Congress, but it becomes really almost minuscule over a 10-year period of time when you consider the enormity of the amount of deficits. It just would not raise that much money. And just the complexities of the severance tax around the country and the things that are being taxed, I think there would be a real, if they would shift onto one, all these other things would come into play. So there's some strange constituencies, I think, that would support the retention of leaving severance taxes alone. I don't know, one set of figures I saw, and I think that's been changed with our change in our severance tax here. It would only, if all severance taxes, the federal government took half them, they would only be talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 or $7 billion. It's just not enough, I would say, to get cut across that states' rights issue and a few other.
One thing that could be done, if I were, say, on the federal side, and we're looking for some way to handle this, I'd look at what happened in Canada, where the federal government disallowed the deduction of provincial royalties as business expense. And so Congress could just disallow state severance taxes above 10% business expense, and let the states fight it out with the producers, and say if the producers couldn't deduct it, the impact on them would be much tougher, and they would start threatening to shut down operations, and in some cases they would simply because they couldn't maintain it. And this was the strategy of the Trudeau government with Alberta, that the combination of the provincial and federal taxes turned out to be more than 100% of net income. And Alberta was threatened with the loss of all of its royalties, as on many fields, because the producers would just shut down to avoid losing money. And so it led ultimately to a compromise where Alberta backed off and the federal government reestablish the deductibility of provincial royalties. I can see that kind of scenario, but I don't think it's very likely. There are too many states that have something specific to lose, and for whom the benefits are very vague.
What about the windfall profits tax? States were excluded from the windfall profits tax, but not without some commotion, as I recall. Yeah. It was a real close vote, and that is what Ted was talking to me about Those were three people that had voted with him on that issue.
Well,
I guess my question is, do those constituencies line up the same way with respect to the windfall profits tax?
These are things that could make differences. I think, again, an important thing was the exemption of Arctic oil other than the South Rochester from windfall profits tax. So Kuparuk is exempt.
I don't want to spend too much time on the politics of envy aspects of things, but maybe we could shift focus a little bit. I wonder if both of you might think about what are the any resource management policy implications for the state?
I was going to ask, well, I guess Dick Cooley will answer to that, because I was going to ask Dick, and in this sadness for the lack of information, and I think I shared that with you and work for the commission and the subcommittee, and really interested in that part. I sense that when I maybe prepare a study, there really was not really Congress per se, but the over specialization of the agency, the polarization of the various federal and state agencies in regard to the control on some of the landholding could have played a phase on non recommending a commission which was seen as too powerful. And I wonder, after some time, look back at what we have created with all these various specialized agencies controlling, and the state with so many different departments in charge of various pieces of land disposal, land leasing, and economic and resources development, if maybe it would be, again, one of the recommendations we can make to relook at that policy at this time, a few years later. Would you see the possibility?
I agree with that. Obviously, no great monolithic kind of agency is going to solve the problem, but there are all kinds of different innovative ways of trying to approach that I think I would hope that this group could explore, or at least recommend that it be explored in depth. Maybe taking off from what a look at the land, the Joint Central State Land Use Planning Commission.
And that would relate to some of your development resources, which, you know, is between state land, federal lands, and private holdings, is a whole ball of wax.
By the way, an interagency committee does not have to be a timid and lawless common denominator. There are a number of alumni of the Federal Field Committee here, I think the Field Committee was anything but what you.
Yeah,
right.
It was not really in a policy-making position at all. It was a much different kind of an organization. One of the questions
more
I wanted
policy
to,
than any other body that's...
Yeah, it just didn't know it wasn't supposed to do it.
Right. It was political.
Like the bumblebee.
Yeah. It was the savvy that they had.
Yeah. No, I think, personally, we could talk about that, and I think it's a good example of what you can do with some innovation, but there are very, very few of those you can point to. And again, it was not an agency in the sense of aligned agency involved. I mean, it was suave and getting people to do what they wanted them to do, and I think that's necessary of any success. Yeah.
Part of its strength was not having any money and not having any authority.
It was a concept more than an agency.
There was another thing, though, too, I think, and that was a mutual respect among the people that were working together. I think one of the things that we have got to deal with somehow is the animosities between the various governmental entities right now, and the turf battles that have gone over the last number of years, and the institutional animosities that have built up are going to make it extremely difficult for us to do anything productive and positive unless we make some positive strides about breaking those down. And I don't see anything right now on the horizon that will do that.
Well, can I add one? That tied to a question I asked about the educational mandate, because I feel the animosity rests a lot with specialization of the various agency mandate, from the geologist on end, the zoologist, the biologist, the economist, the planner. They're also over-specialized and start in the classroom, where I don't mean to the cliché holistic, but at least interrelated studies somehow. So I hope, I don't know, Alaska can be the beginning of the Renaissance, but maybe some new thoughts could come from the classroom to the agent's implementation. It's a whole interaction. At least this is what I seems to see, and I wonder, you're a teacher too, Vic, if you see this type of things.
Very much so. I'd like to just comment or raise a question as an outsider listening to this earlier conversation and the points that you raised. There is a feeling in various parts of the country, you know, how come Alaskans can get all of that money and we don't get any of it, and we've got all of these problems. The cities that Paul mentioned and one thing and another. And whether it's right or wrong or whether there's any legal way to do it, if it's an issue there that has to be dealt with, and I don't think maybe publicity will help, but it'll have to be done in a very suave manner. But the question I wanted to raise is that from the discussions here, it sounded like to an outsider, here is Alaska, no matter what your last year's problems were in your budget and how much you overspent, maybe it's so much you never get out of it again. But to an outsider, here is a state for the first time in the history of our country has enough money that they don't have to continue to use that same old shibboleth that we've got to continue to develop our economy the same old way in order to get some money because we got to pay off of our bill, all of these bills off. That happened in Alaska right after statehood, and that was very true. There was no alternative for the state to dispose of lands in a way that probably was not very rational from the long-term point of view that they had to pay the state bills. Now there is a state in our nation that is not confronted with that kind of direct situation to an outsider, I'm speaking. And then why isn't the whole effort that not how do we increase the economy further, which it sounded like to me in part you were saying this is all going to induce more people in, we'll have more of the same and keep building this thing further and further with no respect as to what that may have to do with the quality of life in Alaska. Or,
Mr. Cooley, money does not bring wisdom. And what you essentially do with a whole lot of money is to take away any processes that you've had to make decisions. And those have been the constraints that are on a finite number of dollars. And all of a sudden, it's monopoly. It really is. You do not take the time to plan, to think through. You do. You have the capacity. The expectation is beat by the paper that says $1 billion. If you had it, what would you do? Well, we damn well have found out what to do. And no, I'm just saying, and not in a way, that is part of the problem that we face is how...
In the Depression, we were all poor. We had cardboard in our shoes, so we knew how to make decisions. There were certain things that were important. And now, all of the pent-up frustrations and so on, you're going to solve it the way we always have, by sometimes by excess if it's there. And so it's how to institute some kind of a rational process when you do have that money. You can see, I mean, I'm shocked. I'm sitting here. I'm on the Finance Committee. If we've overspent... We took care of $600 million by putting it into fiscal year 83. Well, it looks like now we're going to have to put another $2 billion into fiscal year 83.
Greg or I was in the on the paper
sure.
about this every day. Greg was walking around talking to people in Juneau during the early part of the session, and the people, I don't know how the message didn't get across to you. I know that a lot of legislators just didn't want to hear it. And because, but the,
and I suspect that I was probably one of those. But just overwhelmed, it was and so that message didn't
Greg was on the front page
a,
of
yeah.
the Daily
All right,
History.
But the issue is not this particular disaster. The issue is what this represents in terms of public policy for the future.
That's right. That's
and
right.
No one really has addressed my second question, which was that we can talk about planning for Alaska's future, but the only people that have control of that future is the legislature. You know, the legislature gave us the land disposal program. The legislature makes all the decisions on major infrastructure.
That's right.
The legislature makes the decision on the dams. The legislature makes the decision on how we're going to spend that money to beef up certain segments of the economy. And if the legislature, well, first I pose the question, is the legislature out of control? And if it is, how on earth can we sit here and rationally discuss Alaska's future when in fact the people that are in charge of making the decisions are involved in an irrational process. And if that is true, what do we do about it? And I would like to hear from somebody in the legislature on the subject. That's why I'd like to hear from somebody in the legislature.
Narrows it down. Nobody's speaking up.
Well, let's. I'd like to hear from somebody in the legislature.
All right. Or
maybe everybody in the
there's
legislature.
There's only, we have others in the legislature. I have to be sitting at the table. And that's one of the questions that I think both Senator Stimson and I pose to you. Because it's the kind of thing you have to do is to build a whole lot of fragile relationships through communication and all the rest. We have certainly an administration who has a great deal to do in providing that direction. I'll give you an example. I'll be very critical. The governor, I happen to be in the same party, so we're trying to put politics down, came in with a capital budget of $225 million. We spent for capital $1.6 billion. Now, what we needed, perhaps, was a plan that would encompass the total of the revenues. We have not developed that either on the executive level, nor have we done it on the individual legislative level. So you're really out of control without understanding the value of the money. Like I indicated, everybody has planning, but we don't really plan. We don't have a process to make decisions. So we make a whole series of individual ones. We enacted a spending limit, which I did not support, that puts a tight lid on operational dollars, but allows mm-hmm. to sky mm-hmm. the capital expenditures. Everybody wants capital, right? But for every dollar you spend, you've got a 25% of that's going into maintenance and operation, and you've got your program costs on top of it. So it's going to distort seriously just our whole delivery system. If I had an answer, I probably wouldn't be at this meeting.
Well, our policies in your deal was sort of towards a paper chase, not towards economic development. Everybody's chasing this paper around. You're not looking at the energy efficiencies of the distribution to people. You're looking at the energy distribution in the form of demand to multinational corporations. I'm sitting out there in knack-knack, and I don't get the myopic view of just looking at this state. I've got to take a geopolitical view of what's happening in knack-knack, because we're going to be impacted right there by oil development. In fact, there's big oil development going on right now in disguise of putting in infrastructure for fisheries. That's bull. It's going in there for oil. We know about it and the whole damn thing. But the state isn't telling us that. Nobody else is telling us that. Everybody's chasing this paper around. They're not looking at the development of the resource or the efficient allocations to people. And what you have is not a production, it's a distribution problem. That was brought up in Global 2000. That was brought up in all these other programs that we've spent millions and millions and millions of dollars, had all this institutional impact into, and yet we find that the fraud within the institution is overtaking what the institution integrity is. And what we find out is that we're all running around in this paper chase, and actually we're not accomplishing anything. Now, I've been in economic development, so-called, since 1962 when we put in the borough government out there. It was overall economic development. We soon seen that we were not looking at overall economic development because information was being denied us at the local level so that we could actually express ourselves in self-local determination. That became a joke. Now, here we are sitting in the state. We're right back in here now, 10 years later, from that first dog and pony show in which everybody was parading all their little wares and doing their show-and-tell hours, and we're right here, coming right back here. What the hell are we talking about? Gee, just like a big, I don't know what the hell this is,
We all know it failed.
Pardon?
We all know it failed.
No, it didn't fail. Now, self and local determination didn't fail because there's people out there that have a lot more ideas of what's going on than people sitting around this table, just like in economic development and fisheries. We're understanding what the title to our resources here. I don't hear anybody talking about title, or what is title, who has title. Now, the CIA is starting to look into that. There's a document that came out in 1978 when they're taking a look at the circumpolar view. The villages are taking a look at the circumpolar view. Some of the areas up in North Slope, they're putting together a circumpolar conference. Where is the state's input into that to assist these people into self and local determination and resource allocation that's most efficient to distribution to human beings? There's no
effort.
Yeah.
Senator, state with, is one mind and one body, and it's not.
That's no, what we're talking about is stealing. Stealing because you do not have title, and once that goes into the, all these resources become contraband, and this would actually allows certain bureaucratic efficiencies to just to allocate those that contraband.
Okay, but Hank, let's get back to the point of the thing.
Right on the time, this time that we took a break. We do. I know everyone's anxious to get to talk about some of these institutional arrangements, not just legislators. And we're here to answer those questions, not just legislators.
That wasn't my point. That wasn't my point, John.
Check into the issue. You get started bugging out here.
All right. Well, let's take a break for 5 and we'll come back.
Has anybody asked Tom?
You can tell my friend.
Have you shown him the $21 price on the email? Compared it with it to me and look back and see what he predicted the June price would be in June. He predicted the June price in June would be $25. It actually was $21.25.
That's why I asked.
I mean, have you done that? Maybe you should do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Come back and ask me.
Well, it's basically your own numbers rather than using state.
Whether it's Demon's numbers or not, the question is whether they have a good tracker, whether they're right. But I'm not using predictions. I'm saying this. If prices stay where they are right now, just don't change. That's bankruptcy as far as I can tell. The prices aren't staying where they are. And that's not a prediction that I make. That's a fact. I got to pull out the demon score sheets every month. These are not predictions. These are actual numbers. I love it.
What Tom thinks the price is going to be for June in June is $25. In essence, now in August, the June price, the actual price of the price
is $25.
Something went through the Senate can do enough. The House is too much. They didn't have the counter, the kind of dialogue.
It's so frustrating to me.
Leave this session.
Because
it will be a session.
The
facts that had developed over the last 6 months prior to what I was saying back in January.
But they were the only ones.
As a consequence of this, I've been increasingly isolated by the people like yourself. Governor's office, Jerry,
they and the government.
As a consequence, it's hard to believe.
Had the guts to go with their intentions.
The difference in
they hadn't been
turned out. I'm scared of it.
It
was,
but the rules of addition are the same.
A malicious,
you don't want to
some rose of plot.
Well, I'm not sure there is either.
Not just that, but like conspiratorial.
None of these things are anybody's
mode.
Yeah, and I appreciate you coming in. There's
nothing
idealistic.
Well, because Arliss is one of the
Well, I'm going to have
the numbers that I gave.
I think just so
we
can
go back to
the
are not projections.
They're across the table.
All I'm saying is that the prices stay where they are right now. It's not where the rules of addition are not subject to a great deal of argument anymore. And that's all the rules I'm using. And that is the okay, if you want us to
project
if they stay the same, and sure, prices in Saudi Arabia could go belly up.
Very good insight.
Maybe right. Maybe we'll get $2 a barrel from exports to Japan. That's a little high to me. Even if we do, it's not going to be enough to make a real material difference.
I don't need them anymore.
But $2 a barrel is not actually talking about $10 a barrel.
Yeah. So have a Miller Sheffield campaign or whatever.
What can I tell you? Go look at your own number.
I can just ask.
I told Sue Green, I pointed these things out to Sue back in March.
Remember, this whole thing resulted in a debate between you and Tom, didn't it? Public debate. Is that still going on?
Well, but the facts are piling up just as I said they would.
What we were getting, I guess, not in any excuse, was between the difference projected by the administration in Milt Barton. That's really what I'm pressing on.
Hey, Milt, go talk to Milt. Milt is, his numbers are a little different than mine, but
well, his numbers were not, but his numbers during the legislature, these are what I saw, were not organic.
Well, right now, he's talking about $1 million. Jerry, our Jamie Love, yesterday on the telephone, he said 1.3. I think he's low, but that's the reason.
See, now that's where the problem is. Now we have three different sets.
Yeah, but you're going to. But the point of it is, you have to develop, and that's what I've got to do right now, is to start to think damn soon about a strategy for Lord. I mean, it becomes a figure. I mean, that in a sense is irrelevant. It's the fact that it's very rapidly declining. So you have to look at
I may be wrong.
What difference does it make whether it's...